Hey, David.
Hey, Mickey, how you doing?
I'm doing okay. So I noticed that both news weeklies have the Cheney quail hunting incident on the cover. I think it traditionally that's a sign that the story is over, not that it's beginning.
Over, yes.
I was worried when if they ever have blogs on the cover or blogging heads on the cover, we're through, we're finished.
Well, hopefully by then we won't have cashed out.
But is there any juice left in the story? I mean, you know, Drudge, I think, completely misinterpreted, and he said, well, the mainstream media is planning another week of Cheney quail shooting coverage. And when it's exactly the opposite.
Sure, well, listen, you know, this story was so delicious, and, you know, we didn't really learn about it till it was too late for the deadlines last week for the two news magazines to go to bed on Saturday. Of course, it happened Saturday, and they made sure no one knew about it really until midday.
That's
Sunday.
A very good point. That could be one of the secrets behind why they didn't do it.
They were scared of Time News. We could probably U.S. News and World Report, too. And so I just think they had to get their licks in. I mean, it's a great story. The guy ends up with birdshot all over his face and in his heart, or near his heart. And the vice president is responsible. And there's a lot of good TikTok to it. What happened? You know, I think you know they're chasing probably the end of the dog at this point in time, which I also think is unfortunate because if you look at those pieces, I forget now whether it was Newsweek or Time, but what you know they get new tidbits out, which is sort of their stock in trade.
Right. There were some good new tidbits, although I was somewhat disappointed.
Well, I thought the good one good new tidbit was the fact that on Sunday morning, the morning after that hunting mishap, the Cheney's traveling party had prepared some sort of press release. And I guess they had faxed it to Mary Matlin for advice, a former talk show host married to James Carville. And she noted that in the press release, the draft press release, it mentioned that there had been an accident, a hunting accident of some type, but didn't say that Cheney was a shooter. Talk about leaving out important pieces of information, which leads me to believe that they were still hoping that they could get away with it somehow.
No, I think they clearly were, although I must admit, if I shot somebody, I would be hoping I could get away with it, too. But I'm not the vice president. But yes, I think
not yet.
That comes through pretty clearly. But the other weird thing is Madeline's involvement. As usual, when you involve Mary Madeline, she then starts blabbing to the press and makes herself the story. There's a big article by Elizabeth Buehmiller in the New York Times, which I don't think serves Cheney well to have Mary Madeline out there saying, well, he had this first statement and really was terrible, didn't even reveal that he was the shooter. Why didn't she rewrite the statement and make it accurate?
And get it out right away?
And get it out right away and keep her name out of the papers as the savior, the woman who saved the day.
I don't understand, you know, the whole consulting business to begin with, which is basically people come in and they tell you what any reasonable sentient person would tell you, but until that point, you're floundering. It seems to me that Cheney or people around him should already have known what to do without calling a former talk show host.
I agree, but one person who doesn't understand Madeline's role is President Bush. The current President Bush doesn't like Madeline. You notice she's not in the administration anymore. She did not get Karen Hughes' job. I have it on pretty good authority that he does not like the way she puts herself in every story, and she talks too much to suspect people like Maureen Dowd.
I got to tell you, she was very close to the Bush campaign. I remember when I used to co-host Crossfire, which I did occasionally, filling in for Bill Press when the show was on the air. And sometimes I'd be up against Mary as the other host, and it was no secret that she was on the phone all day with the Bush campaign, not all day, but quite a few times during the day, you know, checking in with them, talking points, figuring out what the best line was. So she was seen as one of their bigger advocates in media, at least cable media at the time, but one can understand that she is a celebrity of her own. How many other vice presidential aides have done American Express commercials? Maybe Scooter Libby will find such work in the future, but he's not there yet.
It is weird. I find her very appealing, but her, you know, as a friend of mine said, she, you know, she's married to James Carville, and their credentials are that for George Bush Sr., she ran the worst presidential campaign in history, and he's the guy who beat the worst presidential campaign in history. So it's not clear that this should vault them to the top ranks of American politics. The one thing I suspected with the Cheney shooting that doesn't seem to be the case, I suspected that Whittington wasn't really his close friend. And that,
well, I think there were a couple of different permutations put forward in the first day or two, whether he was a close friend, associate. I think at one point Cheney or someone for him said he was friendly with the fellow. So that went through several changes as well.
I mean, but my initial instinct was, well, Cheney just, he said it wasn't friendly with him, and he sort of ignored him and didn't realize he was there. And that made it sort of look worse because, you know, this, it was sort of a rank thing that, that, you know, he was a lesser person, so Cheney ignored him. But
well, at least he didn't shoot the dame who was traveling with him. Come on. you know, our ambassador to Switzerland, another presidential political appointment, that would have been that would have given the story a different hue.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't dare go to Fire Dog Lake CSI because I have a feeling that they're going to come up with something that's going to prolong the story, and I would just as soon move on.
Well, I will not fight the move on aspect of this, but I do think it is actually a bit unfortunate that we don't get a good investigation, and I say there's a, you know, small possibility. I don't think it's a probable, it's a great probability, but a relatively, you know, worrisome possibility that perhaps something untoward did happen at some point, either after the shooting or in the course of the shooting, that has been kept from the American
public. Untoward, like drinking.
Drinking, maybe just wobbling. You know, who knows? I mean, the hunting experts who said, you know, they said that they found it odd that somehow Whittington was struck when Cheney says he was in a gully and you're supposed to be aiming up to shoot those quails. I mean, the things like that. I mean, it could have just been a real, it could have been not just a, you know, a regular hunting accident, but perhaps a really, really stupid one.
You mean like a gun going off by accident when the guy was really 10 feet away or something?
Something like that. You know, hey, look at me. I can, you know, want to see my fancy gun tricks?
That's possible. But I guess we should move on since we don't really know.
Ring the bell. There you go.
The story, the real story that's completely this blown Cheney off the blogosphere and off, is about to blow him off the front pages, is this story about the ports, the port storm, as Drudge calls it, the United Arab Emirates, actually a state-owned outfit, as I understand it, is buying the firm that runs six major American ports, and there's a huge brouhaha over that. What do you think of this?
Well, I posted something earlier today, which I said, how long will it take the deep politics conspiracy theorists to find ties between this Dubai company and the Bush dynasty. And I will eat those words a little bit because it wasn't a conspiracy theorist who came up with this connection, but actually the Daily News. It turns out that Treasury Secretary John Snow and a fellow named David Sanborn, who's been appointed to the U.S. to head the U.S. Maritime Administration. I'm sure you're very familiar with the workings of that federal agency, Mickey. That both of these people their firms have done business with the Dubai company. And people go around thinking that Karl Rove and others in the White House are just evil geniuses who always get everything right, except when they're being incredibly boneheaded. And it seems to me, substance aside, to turn over, you know, the management of ports, which also means the security of the ports, to a company that's state-owned by the United Arab Emirates, it's just not smart politically, and you're just asking for trouble and for investigations. I'm not sure how far this will go on Capitol Hill, but just imagine. You know, I always just do the flip test. Imagine if Bill Clinton had done this. You know what the Republicans in Congress and Rush Limbaugh and all the others would be saying? It'd be worse than what he did with the Chinese, in which he actually handed them our top secret missile plans and returns in return for campaign cash.
Well, Well, sure, and it gives every Democrat a cheap shot at getting to Bush's right on an issue in which the public will support them, and it gives all sorts of right-wingers like Frank Gaffney a chance to get in there. And this morning I had thought that clearly this deal is doomed, and the only issue is can Bush come up with a face-saving way to get out of it that doesn't annoy the entire Arab world by seeming to hold all Arabs as people we can't do business with. But he came out apparently with a very strong statement in support of it today, and I don't understand that. It seems like a total loser for him.
Well, I think politically it is. I mean, there's no political gain here. Now, if you sit back and talk about the substance of this, is this a good idea? We still are we're 4.5 years or so after 9/11, and the experts on security, Homeland Security, tell us still that port security is rather weak. The Association of American Ports, I'm getting press releases from them every couple of months saying that the port security is being underfunded by billions of dollars. And so it has been sort of a back burner issue. The Democrats tried to make it into a real issue in the last two elections and didn't get anywhere with it. On substance, it was just port security seemed too esoteric to most people. But you sort of take that issue now. It's not just not providing enough port security and enough funding for this or focusing on it, but you're actually giving management of the ports over to a company that is connected to the government of the United Arab Emirates. Without being demagogic about it, I would say it doesn't strike me as a good idea policy-wise, and politically, it looks like it's a real dog.
I mean, a reasonable paranoia would... I mean, there's all this talk about... Oh, we have procedures in place, and it's really the ports are really run by Americans, and they're manned by the same Americans that were manning them before. But if you're reasonable paranoid, all you worry about is an order that one guy should be off his watch for a few hours on a specific day to let somebody sneak in some evil container, and I don't see how any procedures can totally guard against that.
No, that's sort of the cinematic, worry here.
Right.
But there may be other things in terms of, to begin with, in terms of how money is apportioned to port security. Maybe a company, everybody will have their financial interest at stake here. But when it comes to lobbying for more port security, will an Arab company. Have a better chance of getting money out of Congress, out of the administration, than an American company?
Well, they seem pretty well connected.
Well, there is that. There is that. Overall, it just strikes me as a bad deal. But I would hesitate to be overly demagogic about it. We already have enough trouble with those cartoons.
Well, that's it would have to be handled very carefully. I mean, the obvious way to do it is to pass a law saying that there could be no foreign ownership. Of any company that runs a port, and that would rule out the British owners as well as the the Arab owners.
I mean, the interesting thing about this issue ideologically is that you have, on the right, you do have conservatives who are, I would call, anti-corporate, ideological-minded, issue-driven conservatives who sometimes find common cause with people on the left, whether it's on free trade agreements, but sometimes they agree that, the corporations have too much power. And then within the Republican world and the Bush administration, you always have this tension between the the pro-business Republicans and the ideological Republicans. You see that, for instance, most prominently with the immigration fight. But you will see that now coming up with this issue. I think as it continues, the Bush people might say, we do business with these guys. Bush's oil friends used to do business with the Bin Laden family. Right. What's the big deal here? But other conservative populists will say, we'll be suspicious of foreigners and putting our security in the hands of foreign corporations. Well, I think raise a fuss about this. Well, I don't know what Rush and others like that will do yet, but I think you're right. Frank Gaffney's and the others will screw.
I get the Bush digging in his heels here. I get the same feeling I got when Dan Rather started to dig in his heels about those memos of the Bush National Guard. I mean. Don't do it. You're just going to add, it's just going to be more trouble digging yourself out of this hole later.
One has to wonder why he cares. I mean, why why care, in the sense that, you know, you dig in your heels, why not just say, hey, you know, well, that's a good argument some people are making. I'm going to take a look at that.
Every now and then, yeah, why not investigate it or, you know, delay it for a month? Every now and then he gets these fits of doing right by the Arab world and not discriminating and not annoying right. them. And maybe this is just one of those fits. But, I mean, his whole hold on the presidency is security, is homeland security. And so we haven't been attacked. Mm-hmm. That's the last prop. And that and the economy are the last props under his government.
And if I were working at the DCCC, the Democratic Campaign Congressional Committee, I would be looking at all those ports that are going to be owned by the Arab company now, and seeing if there are any competitive districts nearby them. Probably not. They're probably mainly, you know, nice blue state areas. But I'm just wondering, you know, if there are one or two races where this might come into play.
Well, good point. Okay. Well, we'll be watching that. I don't want to be defensive of Bush, but if I were, I would fear the worst for him. There was a conference in Washington about weapons of mass destruction. It was supposed to show us that Saddam really had them. Did you go to that conference?
No, actually, I was supposed to go. In my capacity as a member of the editorial board of PajamasMedia.com, and one of their featured bloggers.
You were commanded to go by the head pajama?
I was requested to go by the head pajama, Roger L. Simon. And it just happened to turn out that my kids had drama class that morning. So I put my priorities straight and gave up the chance to listen to a lot of right-wing people talk about how Saddam really had WMDs in order to watch my six-year-old dance to the wonderful music of Grease, the musical.
There's a cheap shot in there somewhere, but
I got a full report afterwards, and they, of course, I'll promote pajamasmedia.com. People can go there for themselves, or they seem to have, you know, a dozen or so bloggers blogging about this. But you can get the facts there. But what it turned out was there were all these tapes that a former UN inspector had gotten. Somehow, I think he'd been asked to translate them because they're in Arabic, tapes between Saddam, conversations with Saddam Hussein and others, which all predate the invasion of Iraq by several years, and in which he is discussing, say, in the mid-90s, how we can fool the inspectors and how we can, you know, still have weapons of mass destruction. I mean, there is no doubt, there's no question that Saddam Hussein wanted to have weapons of mass destruction, had them at a time, wanted to fool the inspectors at a time. All that stuff is historically established, and there's no debating it. The only relevant question is, in the years up to the invasion of Iraq, you know, particularly after 98, when the inspectors left, had he built up a stockpile or started up the nuclear weapons program that the inspectors, the IAEA inspectors, had shut down and dismantled in 1998? And so whatever he was saying about fooling inspectors or having wishes for WMD programs, you know, in the mid-90s, is really rather irrelevant to what the president told us, the American public and the world, before the invasion of Iraq, which is that there was no doubt, that we have no doubt, that he's pursuing weapons of mass destruction, and had stockpiles, and was actively seeking nuclear weapons. None of this changes that.
It seemed to be a total bust. I think that you know, Roger and the people who were sort of hoping that this would prove that Saddam had WMDs would have been better advised to go see your son's production of Grease, because this was there's the cheap shot. But this was a bust, a setback. I mean, Byron York has a piece in the National Review about this guy Tierney, about how his religiosity sort of overwhelms any credibility. He says God has directed him to the WMD stashes, mm-hmm. yet this tape do not show that Saddam had WMDs. There actually was, you know, I'm open to the idea that he did, and then these tapes didn't show any evidence of that.
Let me tell you why you should close your mind to that.
Okay.
And that is, you know, if you talk to David Kay and Charles Dofer, the two inspectors who ran the search for weapons of mass destruction after the initial wave, I can't say after the war, since the war is still ongoing. I mean, they will tell you that they it wasn't about of looking for the actual weapons and, like, you know, as if they could have been moved to some, you know, Walmart somewhere. It was what they both did, and it was actually a very smart way of going about it, was they looked for anybody, any witnesses. If you built weapons of mass destruction, if you're storing them, if you're maintaining them, if you're transporting them, if you have a nuclear weapons program, there are going to be lots and lots of people who are involved, from the janitor on to the guys, the top ministers overseeing this.
Mm-hmm.
And so they went looking for anybody who could give them credible testimony that these things either existed or had existed or were being produced or were being sought after. And, you know, David Kaye tells me that he had literally a slush fund of millions of dollars. You know, put out a big sign. You could be rich if you could give me, you know, any intelligence, any information on this. They got absolutely nothing from nobody. I mean, that's just it. The whole notion, and we every couple months, you know, stories bubble up. You know, reports that the weapons of mass destruction were moved to Syria. The bottom line is that both Charles Dofer and David Kaye are pretty firm on this. You know, they leave open, you know, the possibility that they missed something, but they're pretty firm in saying there was nothing there to be moved.
What about these two generals who've come forward?
One general.
I read Lucien, and every few weeks there's been Iraqi general who says, oh, we moved them to Syria.
Yeah, well, there was one guy who came out recently, an Air Force general who has a book, and he claimed that in the weeks, I guess, before the invasion, there were dozens of flights from Iraq to Syria in which they took all the seats out of these airliners and shoved the planes full of weapons of mass destruction. And he didn't see it himself. He knows about this because he talked to two pilots who flew those planes, but now they're flying for airlines in European nations, and they won't come forward. I mean, again, you go back to what David Kaye and Charles Dofer say, and you can read the Dofer report. I mean, he talks about all the people he talks to, and they both found that there was no program. There was nothing that could have been produced. And, you know, it seems to me possible that somebody squirreled away something somewhere at some point in time, and maybe that will bubble up. But in terms of an institutional program to either maintain and store and produce chemical and biological weapons, and a program to develop nuclear weapons, there was nothing, certainly nothing significant, nothing approaching the levels that Bush and the war backers here depicted them.
What about the Saddam Al-Qaeda connection? I think this conference was supposed to shed some light on that, too.
Yeah, I think, well, that's got even less attention. Again, you know, I didn't see any tapes that came out that sort of said, aha, we have to, you know, this new guy, Bin Laden, he, you know, he's promising, let's bet on that horse.
But
again and again and again, all the intelligence, everyone who's looked at this, is just not, you know, except for Stephen Hayes at the Weekly Standard, have not come up with any of the operational links. And, you know, were there contacts? There may well have been contacts. I would expect that intelligence... This thing keeps slipping out. You can't see this, Mickey. But I would say that, you know, intelligence services for lots of Middle Eastern or Arab countries were probably at some point keeping tabs on Al-Qaeda. But the question always was whether there was an operational relationship. Bush told us, I think it was November 2002, that Al-Qaeda was, that Saddam Hussein was dealing with Al-Qaeda.
But there was some sort of tacit cooperation where Saddam agreed to look the other way or not to attack. It's not true that there was no cooperation.
There were contacts, but the biggest thing they talked about was that Saddam and Iraq had provided training and chemical weapons and explosives to Al-Qaeda. Turns out that came from just one Al-Qaeda source, a guy named Al-Libi, who then recanted.
Why can't you take my view on it is sort of it's a little like the relationship between Bill Clinton and Patricia Duff Medavoy. I mean, they hadn't met, they didn't have an affair, but it was only a matter of time. Before it was rudely interrupted. It was only a matter of time before Saddam got together with Osama.
I'm not quite sure. That's very much an Austin Powers view of the world. Or, you know, all the evil doers, you know, meet together in some, you know, high-tech conference room with exploding chairs.
I've become very cinematic now that I'm here in Hollywood.
Well, that may be it. And again, listen, I think Bush had an argument for war before the war. I think if he come and said, listen, Saddam can't be trusted. We don't know whether he has weapons of mass destruction, but he's had them in the past. Maybe we've kept him in the box, but we can't do that forever. And after 9/11, the stakes go up. And again, all one has to do is imagine that he gets together with Al Qaeda, not that he has, and think about how terrible it would be. Given these prospects, isn't it prudent to take him out beforehand? Now, the question I have is whether the American public would have gone for that honest. That's an honest policy argument.
Right.
I'm not sure they would have, which is why they went with the scare the people now plan.
Right. He could have made an honest implant democracy in the Middle East argument, too, but he felt that wasn't enough either.
Well, that definitely would not have gone over, I think.
Yeah. And probably with good reason, although that actually brings us to our next topic, so I'll ring the bell.
Good.
Francis Fukuyama has an essay in the New York Times where he basically argues that the war wasn't worth it. And he sort of renders a negative, since history is going to render a negative verdict on Iraq and the neoconservative movement of which he was, I don't know if he was a part or not, you tell me, is in shambles. And it's an odd essay that's caused a lot of talk. I have some views on it, but what did you think?
Well, I thought it was actually a very well done and valuable essay. I mean, he's tremendously harsh on the war in Iraq, challenging not just the neoconservative position, but that of the Bush administration, saying that the costs at this point in time seem to far outweigh any benefits, and that history's judgment will likely be very harsh on this. And then he sort of spins away from that to talk about how this fits into the whole neocon view of the world, which is to promote American hegemony. I like saying that, American hegemony, and to do so in a messianic fashion under the banner of promoting democracy. And he talks about how that doesn't always lead to greater security, and that the imposition of democracy on countries abroad is a rather problematic endeavor. Not that one should not. No, he's not saying that we should be cynical and completely realpolitik and not try to encourage democracy where we can, but not to sort of be blunderbusses about it, and not to do it in sort of a black and white comic book style, which is, I think, how Bush has been approaching this, and weirdly, in a way, the neocons as well, given the fact that they are intellectuals, and intellectuals often seem to be engaged by the nuances and the wrinkles of policies, and not always motivated by by such bold strokes. I thought a very convincing and well done piece. But there was one thing that he left out that I felt compelled to blog about, and that is while he is very, I'm going to call this up here, while he was very down on the neocons and says he no longer can support them, he left out an interesting fact, which is that about 9 days after September 11, sort of the neocon Central Command, the Project for a New American Century, headed by Bill Kristol, sent a letter to Bush saying, well, yeah, we have to go after Al-Qaeda, but Iraq, that's really the deal to do here. That's really what we have to focus on now. Iraq, and we, if that means getting rid of, they say we have to get rid of Saddam Hussein by all necessary means. That letter was signed by Bill Kristol, let me see who else here, calling up. Bill Kristol, Robert Kagan, Clifford Maid, Gene Kirkpatrick, Richard Pearl, Marty Peretz, Norman Von Haritz, Charles Krauthammer, Leon Wieseltier, Mitch Decter, Frank Gaffney, and a host of other neoconservatives and conservatives, including Francis Fukuyama.
Leon signed it? I'm shocked.
Yeah, I know. You couldn't tell where I was heading there, I'm sure. And but what's interesting, and this is sort of the explosion of the neocon moment after 9/11. A lot of these people have been talking about going into Iraq for years, and people may forget this, and maybe they didn't pay attention at the time because there were bigger things to think about. But literally, in the days after 9/11, you had a lot of the neocons at AEI and writing op-ed pieces and writing for the National Review, Jim Woolsey, the former CIA director, all saying, listen, now's the time to focus on Iraq. And Francis Fukuyama was right aboard that train.
And he doesn't fess up to that really in the piece.
No, he doesn't. I think it'd be sort of more powerful if you'd explain how he got sort of swept up by that and then saw the error of his ways.
I agree. I thought the whole, you know, he's a smart guy and he's always, and it's certainly a well done piece, but it's way too fashionable. It seems to me he's, you know, he's too pessimistic about Iraq. He sort of says it's more of a failure than probably even he thinks. And he's so fashionably pessimistic about democracy. Oh, Hamas won. Oh, the Shiite religious parties won. That even he doesn't buy it. He takes it all back at the end of the piece and says, well, in the long run, democracy might work well in Palestine because you can only make peace with Hamas. You couldn't make peace with Fatah. And it might even work well in Iraq. And he's sort of a phony piece in that respect. He has not abandoned the neocon push for a democracy. He just thinks it should be pursued a little more realistically, which is a sensible position, but it sort of belies the incredibly pessimistic confessional beginning of the piece.
Well, I think, you know, the pessimism at the start of the piece is far more geared to Iraq than anything else. And, you know, we're all guessing here about how bad or not so bad it might turn out. But at this point, in terms of what it's done to the America's position in the world and what it's done to America's ability to be engaged elsewhere, I think is pretty undeniable. Which is, I think, what sets him off perhaps the most, because, you know, he is one of those geostrategists who would like to see America doing all sorts of things around the world and now believes that that's virtually impossible because of what's happened in Iraq.
Do you really think that if we hadn't invaded Iraq that we would be ready to go after North Korea? I mean, there's a reason we can't go after North Korea, because they would, before we could get to them, they would destroy Seoul.
Yes, no.
We were going to go after them anyway.
No, that is true. Iran might be a little bit of a different case, because hopefully they don't have anything yet. But nevertheless, I'm not even talking about military action. I think in terms of, you know, being a world leader and calling for certain values and engaging in, you know, tough non-military diplomacy, that has been dealt a blow, and that America, you know, is particularly weak. And it might be weaker now in dealing with North Korea because Russia, China, all those other countries that you need to rope into these things may be less ropeable because of Iraq.
Right. You have to speak up a little because I'm having trouble hearing you. But the one thing I thought that the one thing I thought he left out of the piece was Israel. He's trying to explain why did all these neocons all of a sudden gravitate toward attacking Iraq.
Right.
He hasn't even mentioned Israel, which...
Well, that is always the delicate elephant in the room.
But he could he could have brought it up.
No, he could have, because they're all on record. They're all on record going back to the, you know, to the 90s, mid 90s, and so on, as favoring a military showdown with Saddam Hussein, not to promote democracy in the region, but to promote strategic stability that will be useful for Israel. I mean, Richard Pearl, Doug Fife, Bill Kristol, all these folks, you know, are on record as being in favor of that. I mean, the whole notion, if you look at their calls for war against Iraq in the 90s and prior to 9/11, and even the ones immediately after 9/11, you don't see a lot of democracy talk. You really don't. That came about really after the Afghanistan campaign.
Hmm. Interesting. But I just think if you're listing five factors, you could have listed it as one of the factors. Nobody would have given him grief for that. It's sort of so obvious that.
No, I think he should have. I mean, that's a big part of the history here, particularly when you have a lot of the neocons who were actually, you know, working for think tanks that were more or less affiliated with the Likud party in the 90s. I mean, and this is not being conspiratorial. You find this stuff on the web. People are, you know, they don't hide this. Richard Perlin, Doug Fife, and guy named David Wormser and others, you know, writing a big strategic paper for, you know, what they hoped the Likud party foreign policy would be in the 90s, which focused on, one of the things it focused on, was confronting Saddam. So, you know, it's not a conspiracy. It's right. Really out there. And Francis must know this history.
Yeah, and he's not talking about, you didn't have to talk about explicit ties. He's talking about what are the possible subtle psychological motives that might have led these people into error. And he's saying, well, you know, we were led astray by the fact that the victory over communism was so much easier, was sort of a fluke. We thought the next victories would be easy, too. And another subconscious motivation that might be at play is that all these people care deeply about Israel. It's nothing sinister about it, but it's obviously something that has a lot of explanatory power.
Well, you go back to, remember what Pat Buchanan said about the Amen Choir in the 91 Persian Gulf War. There's, a tremendous sensitivity here. The people are worried that, you know, that pro-loving, pro-Israel, I say Israel-loving American Jews get a hold of foreign policy and then use it to more to Israel's advantage than to that of the American GIs who are being sacrificed overseas.
Right, but people are oversensitive about raising the topic. People, you know, I've raised the topic and people have attacked me and Kinsley's raised the topic and they back down because they know it's true.
Yeah, well, I think so, and I'm not disagreeing with you here.
Yeah.
But, you know, it comes within this, you know, this very overly delicate, you know, context.
It does help if you're Jewish and you raise the topic, I guess. I don't know, maybe not. Some have said that, not me. Okay, on to the life kicker. Dana Bilbank.
Yes.
Was dressed down by the Washington Post ombudsman for appearing on Keith Olbermann's show dressed in hunting gear as a sort of a joke about the Cheney Quail incident. And I am completely against the use of cheap props by otherwise dignified commentators in an attempt to make compelling images, and the moose here agrees too.
Give me that question one more time because I lost you at the very end.
Oh, it just the moose and I were objecting to the use of cheap props, I was wondering whether you thought Milbank overstepped those bounds or not.
Well, I had advocated that the Democratic members of the Senate here in Washington should all come to the next session wearing orange hunting vests. After all, Dick Cheney is the president of the Senate. But then I take journalists more seriously, I think, than Democratic senators. Tactically, you know, I think it was a mistake for Dana to do that. Because he's in this odd position at the Post, where he writes this, you know, the sketchbook type of column, which he mixes, you know, he calls it observational judgment. Some people might call it opinions. And he always gets, you know, one side or the other, mainly conservatives. Sometimes he pisses off liberals, upset, and they say, you know, he's not really being a reporter. He's not being, you know, what is his column doing in the news pages? I remember, you know, one of my favorite columnists of all time was Mary McGrory, who wrote for the Post, and she would write opinionated reporting pieces that they would put in boxes, sometimes on page 2, page 3, and then they eventually moved her to the op-ed page. But it really wasn't. But she wasn't a columnist. She was really a reporter. I mean, I trip over hearings all the time, and that's what I like about Dana's work. And, you know, is that he does go out there and he observes and he sees things, and so he's not really, you know, a typical thumb-sucking columnist or blogger.
Right.
No offense to either one of us.
Right, I agree with that.
And so, but because, you know, a lot of people don't see the distinction here, and I think the Post would be well advised to do something very simple and just put a little box around his columns, you know, and just separate them a little bit from the news stories that they're next to. They'd be fine, but I think because of that position he's in, going on Keith Olbermann's show and yucking it up too much with props is probably not the wisest thing to do. And I say that because I do think I'd like to see his column remain in the Post, and more or less in the capacity it's in at the moment.
He's a very good reporter and very substantive guy. I think he's become a little unhinged with anti-Bush sort of disdain perhaps justified over the past few years. Maybe it's because I don't share it, that it's bothered me that much. But, you know, all the other guys who are reporting on Bush, half of them hate Bush, too.
Right, and they repress until you get situations like the vice president shoots a guy in the
face. Well, so you got to put boxes around them, too?
No. But I do think there's a difference. You've been a journalist as long as I have, probably a few years more. But you recognize there's a difference between going to, you know, White House press conferences, you know, taking dictation. This is what the president says. This is what the Democrats say. And going to the, you know, which is what ends up being most news stories or most reported pieces in broadcast journalism, or going to a news conference and Ari Fleischer says, here are like my five explanations, and then you go and you just knock them out of the park, one after the other, and say, this doesn't make sense, this doesn't make sense, this doesn't make sense. And now, is that showing a hatred or a bias? I don't know, but I do think that the former can be done, you know, to a fair degree, separated from what one feels about the subject matter. The latter might be more motivated by one's own reactions. As a guy who wrote a book called The Lies of George W. Bush, I can't really say that I think Dana's gone over the top here in his anti-Bush criticisms, but I really think that ultimately the job of journalism should be not to just display the world, but to explain it. And I think he does a pretty good job of that.
No, I guess I agree, and I guess there is a line there. Maureen Dowd's front page story sort of helped blur the line during the Clinton era. She was very effectively pointedly anti-Clinton in a couple of places, but I guess she did stay on one side of the line. So, but I agree that the most valuable journalism is often on the other side of the line. You know, there are guys like, there's a guy named Michael Hiltzik who writes for the L.A. Times, who previously had been an objective reporter on a bunch of important stories, and now he has a blog, and it turns out he's a flaming, you know, liberal maniac. And he was the guy who was only you know, a few years ago, was alleged to be the neutral reporter. Obviously, he's the same guy. So there's a certain...
Well, you know, listen, there's no such thing as a neutral reporter in terms of what they think about things. Everybody covering... Anyone who cares enough to be a reporter and not go to law school or become an investment banker or something that may be even more remunerative, anyone who chooses a path of that course cares about public policy to some degree, cares about politics. They have ideas, they have opinions. And, you know, is it surprising that, you know, when they are unhinged or untethered from the obligation to play it straight, that they express, you know,
right,
strong opinions?
No, it's not. But that's why I sort of wondered why everybody was potting on Dana. I think it's more of a fashion criticism than anything else. But no, I agree. The box would be a good idea. I should say that Dana is now writing stuff for Slate, so he's sort of a colleague of mine. Mm-hmm. So I have that conflict of interest, and I like him personally. Anyway, No more cheap props unless you're doing TV on a blog.
I think so. Listen, he's a target himself, so he should keep the hunting gear back in the closet.
Definitely. Okay, well, it's been real.
Or virtual.
thank you. See you soon.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, see you there.
Bye.
Bye.